It's hard to believe that the whole book of Jonah, the whole story of Jonah, is contained in just 48 verses. 48 verses. I never really counted them up, but you could literally read the whole book, the whole story in 10 minutes. And I'm going to try and summarize the book today rather than read through the whole book and repeat a lot of what Catherine said. But just some detail as we jump into the story. Nineveh was located about 550 miles northeast of Samaria. It was on the east side of the Tigris River. So it was a good month, a month's journey from where Jonah started out. And obviously we know the story that when God first spoke to Jonah, Jonah went in the opposite direction from where he was supposed to go. And it's interesting that the biblical text doesn't say that he goes in the opposite direction of Nineveh. It says that Jonah goes away from the presence of the Lord. And we know in the Bible that's kind of impossible to do. If you've ever read that beautiful Psalm, Psalm 139, David says how impossible it is to try and escape God's presence. Because no matter where we go, God is there. But basically the text is telling us that every time we engage in disobedience, every time we decide to do something different than what God has told us, We put ourselves out of fellowship from God. The text says in verse 3 that he was hoping to escape from the Lord. And the Lord, as we know, hurled a powerful wind over the sea, causing a violent storm. And the sailors are up in arms and they're throwing the cargo over the boat. And they finally end up taking lots to see who's responsible for this. And God miraculously works through the casting of lots to identify Jonah as the culprit. And they're asking everybody to pray to their God. It's kind of like the story of Elijah all over again. Everybody call to whatever God they worship and we'll see who responds. And none of these other gods, these false gods, respond. And so finally they say to Jonah in verse 8, you know, what's your line of work? What country are you from? What's your nationality? Who's the God that you serve? And he responds in verse 9 by saying, I am a Hebrew and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. And that doesn't sound very interesting to us, but you have to know that these people worshiped individual gods. They worshiped the God of rain, or they worshiped the God of the crops, or of fertility, or the sky god. But that when somebody said, I worship the God who made it all, the God who is responsible for the sea and the dry land, they knew that this was the God of the Israelites, the God that many of them wanted to be in relationship with, but their perception was, oh, he's only for Israel, he's not for us. So as much as we'd love to serve him, that's not an option available to us. And when Jonah says this, they're terrified. Like, why in the world would you be running away from this God? And so what do? You know, they try and row some more and do everything they can to avoid drastic measures, but finally Jonah says, you know, you need to throw me overboard. If you throw me overboard, the storm will stop. And that's what they do. And in verse 15, it says the storm stopped at once. It's kind of like Elijah calling down fire from heaven. All these other people are chanting and calling to their gods and nothing happens. And finally, Jonah is thrown overboard and the sea is immediately calm. And it says in verse 16 that the sailors were awestruck by the Lord's great power. And they offered him a sacrifice and vowed to serve him. So there's like this immediate conversion of everyone on board. They believe in the one true God. And then God arranges for a fish to swallow Jonah. And we don't know if it was a whale, but we know it was large enough to swallow Jonah. So it had to be one really big fish. Chapter 2 is all about Jonah inside of the fish. And we're not going to read that, but leave it to say that Jonah came to know God a lot more personally inside the fish. You know, if you've ever watched Pinocchio, it wasn't like Pinocchio. It wasn't like he lit a match and you could see inside and he kind of set up shop and stuff. It had to be smelly inside of this fish. It had to be dark. The stomach acid of the fish, theologians and scholars say that it had to have bleached Noah's skin and his hair to where he was just white. He came out looking just pure bleached white. And I'm guessing he didn't sleep at all in the 3 days and the three nights. Interesting, that's exactly what Christ was in the tomb. 3 days, three nights, kind of a parallel here. But I'm guessing he didn't sleep for any of that time because Think of the water level inside of the fish constantly moving around. You know, he could have drowned. He's probably vigilant, and he's just praying constantly to the Lord. And then finally, God in chapter 2, verse 10, orders the fish to spit Jonah out on dry land. So we see again that God has control over everything. I want to pick up the story in chapter 3. You can either listen along or follow along in your Bible. The text says, then the Lord spoke to Jonah a second time. It's kind of like, Jonah, let's take two. Let's try this again. Get up and go to the great city of Nineveh and deliver the message I've given to you. And the text says, at this time, Jonah obeyed the Lord. Last time he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord. This time he's going according to the word of the Lord. I'm losing my notes. Last time it says that he went down. He rose and literally went down, not only geographically, but figuratively. And then he paid the fare, or he paid the price for his disobedience. But this time he did what God said. And Nineveh was such a big city that if you look at verse 3 and verse 4 in chapter 3 in your Bible, it says that it was a day's journey. That's if you walk from one end of the city to the other. And it says that he kind of tried to get a view of it. So he walked around the circumference. He walked around the outside of it, which was a three-day journey. It was about 60 miles in all, proclaiming a message, really kind of giving them the gospel, except there wasn't much hope. There wasn't much, you know, chance for change within the gospel. He was just preaching that, you know, you're going to perish in 40 days. God's giving you 40 days and he's going to wipe you out. And listen to the response. It says, from the greatest to the least, they ended up declaring a fast and putting on burlap to show their sorrow. And the king heard about it, and he ordered the same thing. He took off his robes. He himself dressed himself in burlap and sat in a heap of ashes. Verse 7, then he and his nobles sent out this decree throughout the city. No one, not even the animals from your herds and flocks, may eat or drink anything at all. And people and animals alike must wear garments of mourning. I was kind of wondering this week, what does it look like for an animal to wear a garment of mourning? You know, you dress your dog in your leftovers, your hand-me-downs, you know, kind of wearing the old clothes. But everyone, the animals and the people alike, were called to mourning. And they were called to pray earnestly to God that they might turn from their evil ways and stop their violence. And the king's thought was, who can tell? Perhaps even now God will change his mind and hold back his fierce anger from destroying us. And verse 10 of chapter 3 says, when God saw what they had done and how they had put a stop to their evil ways, he changed his mind and decided not to carry out the destruction that he had threatened. Powerful, powerful story. God had compassion. He saw their change of heart and he honored that. Chapter 4 is interesting. Chapter 4, first verse. This change of plans greatly upset Jonah, and he became very angry. The end of chapter 4 is going to tell us that there were 120,000 people that didn't know their left hand from their right hand. And that's really the Bible's way of describing children. There were about 120,000 kids in Nineveh that were so young that they weren't able yet to differentiate between their left and right hand. Theologians, historians believe there were probably about 600,000 people in Nineveh altogether. And Jonah is so eager for their destruction that he's angry. He's angry that God changed his mind. Hard to believe. And he says, this is why I ran away to Tarshish, because I knew that you were a merciful and compassionate God, slow to get angry and filled with unfailing love. You're eager to turn back from destroying people. And as I read this, friends, I thought, you know, never blame your disobedience and your sin upon God. Bad move, bad move. Verse 3, he says, just kill me now, Lord. I'd rather be dead than alive if what I predicted will not happen. And if I was God, I would have said, I can make that happen. You know, I'm tired of your whining. I'm tired of your horrible attitude, the fact that you have no compassion. You're going to have more compassion for a plant that I'm going to create in the next day that gives you shade. You're going to be more invested in the life of this plant than you are in 600,000 people and the potential of them losing their life. And so the Lord instead says, is this right for you to be angry about this? And Jonah's so angry, he doesn't even answer God. But the text says that he went to the east side of the city, outside of the city, and made a makeshift shelter and set it up, waiting to see what's going to happen to the city. He wants a front row seat to see if God decides and changes his mind again to destroy the city. It says God arranged for a leafy plant to grow there, and soon it spread its broad leaves over Jonah's head, shading him from the sun. This eased his discomfort, and Jonah was very grateful for the plant. But God also arranged for a worm. And the next morning at dawn, the worm ate through the stem of the plant so that it withered away. And the sun grew hot, and God arranged for a scorching wind, east wind, to blow on Jonah. And the sun beat down on his head until he grew faint and wished to die. Death is certainly better than living like this, he exclaimed. And again, God says to Jonah, is this right for you to react this way? And this time Jonah's miffed and he responds. He says, yes, it is right. I'm angry enough even to die. And again, I would have said, okay, let's make that happen because I'm just tired of hearing you complain. But the Lord says, you feel so sorry about this plant, though you did nothing to put it there. It came quickly and died quickly. But Nineveh has more than 120,000 people living in spiritual darkness. Other translations say, who don't know the difference between their right hand and their left hand. Not to mention the animals. Shouldn't I feel sorry for such a great city? Kids, I want to talk to you for a moment. So if you're a kid here, and I know you got to sing a song and hear a great story from Catherine, but I have a story about when I was your age, about 100 years ago, back when there were covered wagons and horses, and I was about your age, and I used to love to go to a thrift store. Oh, man. Ouch. I grew up in Santa Barbara, and I used to go to Hollister Street. Hollister Street was in Goleta, and I used to go to this thrift store that was located right across the street from the very first Habit restaurant. The Habit restaurant started in Goleta. On Hollister Road, and I went to go to this little thrift store. And my friends and I loved this thrift store because you could go there and get comic books, you could get baseball cards, you could get old stamps and old coins. It was kind of our secret because we would save up money either through recycling cans or doing yard work or whatever we could do at our young age. And we'd take our money and we'd buy all this cool stuff from the thrift store. And yet we didn't want to share that secret with anybody else, especially our enemies, not to mention our friends, because then the thought was they'll go there and they'll buy all the cool stuff. And we go, there won't be all this cool stuff to buy anymore. And we kind of had this mentality like, let's protect that just for us. Why would we share that wonderful news with anybody else? Because then it won't be available to us. Kind of analogous to that is I grew up on Old San Marcos Road. And Old San Marcos Road in Santa Barbara is the old stagecoach road that connects with Highway 154 up by Kachuma Lake. And it connects right by Painted Cave. Painted Cave was where real Indians used to live, real Native Americans. That was another place that we thought was just our secret. We got to go and check out these drawings on the walls of the cave and this whole setup that over the years very few people knew about, at least we thought so. And again, we thought, why share this with anybody else? But you know, the older that I get, the more I enjoy sharing secrets with other people. Because I found the older that I get, when I enjoy something, when I love something, my enjoyment is enhanced by telling other people about it and letting them experience it too. I remember there's a hot springs located in Montecito. And my whole life I heard about it, but I never knew where it was. And finally, just about probably 7 years ago, I hiked with my family and we discovered it. And man, I couldn't tell enough people, hey, it's still there. You can actually get to it. This really cool hot springs. There's another place located up by Kachuma Lake called Knapp's Castle. It's this old mansion that this really wealthy guy built and a fire came and destroyed it. But you can see the ruins. There's like an outdoor amphitheater and the ruins of this castle right near Kachuma Lake. And we discovered where that was. Or, you know, over the years, we'd love to go to a place in Maui called Napili Shores because it's kind of the north side of the island and it's kind of not as touristy as other areas. And every time you discover something awesome and great, it's fun to share it with other people and let them go and experience it and see it and enjoy it as well. And Do you know what the gospel is, kids? Anybody know what the gospel is? The gospel, very simply, is God's good news about how we can have a personal relationship with him through his son, Jesus. That's the gospel. How we can have a personal relationship with God himself through his son, Jesus. And the good news about the gospel is that we can share that good news. We can share about God's mercy and his grace and his forgiveness with as many people as we want. And it never diminishes. It never diminishes God's supply. It's available to everyone who asks and everyone who seeks him. And what a good story that is. That as much as we share that good news with others, more and more people can enjoy that. And there's never less for us, but there's enough for everyone. And that's really the story of Jonah in a nutshell. Now, adults, I want to cover 3 points today, 3 quick points. And the first thing that I want to cover out of this story of Jonah is, number one, never forfeit the grace of God. Never forfeit the grace of God. My favorite verse in the whole book of Jonah is found in chapter 2, verse 8. The New International Version puts it like this. It says, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could have been theirs. Powerful verse. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could have been theirs. I like the way the New Living Translation puts it. It says, those who worship false gods turn their backs on all God's mercies. When we hold on to doing things our way rather than God's way, we miss out on what God has for us. And when you look at the message that Jonah preached to the Ninevites, like I said, it was the worst gospel message ever because it was all about judgment. There was no hope at all. But did you notice the people's response? They listened and they repented. They changed. And what an encouragement that is to us, that you can preach the worst gospel message in the world. And if God is ready to save people and change people, it's still going to happen. That's encouraging. The people repented of their ways and turned to God. And it made me think this, why would we ever withhold God's goodness and the message of that from anyone? Why would we ever not want other people to enjoy what we've experienced? Even our worst enemy. One person said once that you never understand the grace of God. You don't belong to him until you understand the grace of God. You really haven't believed in him until you understand the grace of God. The day you understand the grace of God is the day that you become born again. It's the day that you finally cross the line from just being a moral person or a good person or a religious person to being a child of God. Because being a child of God is not about being perfect. It's not about doing all the right things. It's about believing in Jesus and what he did for us. And when we grasp that truth, it changes us. It electrifies us. We never get enough of it. Historians tell us that the great theologian Martin Luther was just this calm, sedate professor until he understood the grace of God, and then he became a fearless champion of the gospel, taking on the whole world. I like what somebody said about grace. They said, grace is being led into a place that you don't deserve to be led into by someone who's not obligated to let you in there. I want to say that again. Grace is being led into a place, given access to a place that you don't deserve to be by someone who's not obligated to let you in there. That's exactly what grace is all about. And friends, the message of grace today in a nutshell is that there's nobody here and there's nobody in this whole world that is so good that they don't need grace. And on the other hand, there's no one so bad that they can't find God's grace through Jesus, because it's available to all. And so the question is, how do we know? How do we know when grace has really become part of our life, when it's changing us? And I would say externally, we know because we lose all of our bigotry, all of our cynicism about sinful, messed up people like Ninevites, because we realize, you know what? I'm sinful. I'm messed up. I'm broken. I'm just like everybody else. And I need God's grace as much as the next person. And internally, we know that God's grace has affected us because We become a person of joy. We become a person of freedom. You know, I don't think God let the fish swallow Jonah to get him where he needed to go geographically. I think God allowed the fish to swallow Jonah so that God could take Jonah where he needed to be spiritually. God changed Jonah inside of that fish. And I wish that I could say that Jonah emerged like Scrooge in the Christmas Carol, kind of a gentler, kinder, more compassionate man. But although Jonah's experience caused him to answer God's call, he answered that call without God's heart. Without God's heart. And friends, it's not enough to do what God tells us to do, but not to have his heart. We all go through hard times. We all go through trials. We all experience suffering. And suffering has the ability to make us more compassionate, more sensitive to other people, more understanding. But it can also make us more selfish, cause us to engage in more self-pity and self-absorption. And that's exactly what it ended up doing to Jonah, because he still didn't understand what God's grace was all about. Tim Keller, one of my favorite pastors and authors, he describes God's grace like this, and kids, you'll like this. It's a nice word picture. He said, grace is like a huge mansion, like a big castle, like a big house. And just when you think that you've seen all of it, you turn a corner and there's an entire hallway full of unexplored rooms. And every time you find a new wing in the house of God's grace, you're lifted and you're brought up to a higher level of life and to greatness. The deeper we understand God's grace, the more it lifts us, the more it transforms us, the more it changes us. And once we've experienced this, why would we ever withhold that from anybody else? So may we never forfeit God's grace from ourselves or from others. The second thing that I see is that we should never attempt to do ministry apart from relationship. Never attempt to do ministry apart from relationship. Did you notice that Jonah never seems to be invested in the people of Nineveh? He never forms any friendships, any relationships. He's angry. He just sets up his beach chair outside of the city and waits to see God smoke it and judge it. How sad. All of these people that had repented and turned to God, he could have discipled them. He could have been there to talk about what a new life in God means and what it looks like. I've said this a lot recently and I'll say it again. I believe the best way for us to navigate relationships with people that are different from us, people that have a different point of view, that have a different perspective, the best way is by being in relationship with them. Being in relationship with all different people, of all different views, of all different ethnicities. Because when we're in relationship with others, we become invested in their well-being and in their success. We care about their situation. We care about their needs. And friends, Jonah did not care at all about the Ninevites. The essence of the gospel is incarnational. It's relational. John 1:1 says that God came from heaven to earth and he lived right there with us. It reinforces that old saying that you've probably heard, that people don't care what you know until they know that you care. Until that you've proven that you truly are invested in other people and are willing to take the time to get to know them and be in relationship with them, they really don't want you to preach to them or just tell them a bunch of stuff. And I really think that's why God had Jonah walk around the city of Nineveh for 40 days proclaiming this message. I think he was hoping that in the midst of walking around, he might get to know people. He might get to engage them and form relationships with them. But instead, he saw them as people that were not long for this world, people that were dispensable. He didn't care about them at all. For Jonah, it was all about the message. It wasn't at all about the audience, about the people. And so here's my last point, and we'll close with this. I believe the message of Jonah is that we need to continually seek the heart of God. We need to continually seek the heart of God. If you're a prophet and you know that God is a compassionate God, a forgiving God, a God that is willing to change his mind and relent from his judgment, and that's not where your heart is, then why in the world are you representing him? Why don't you go find another God who's more sadistic or evil or vengeful? I mean, that's the kind of God you want to represent if that's truly where your heart is. The first thing we have to do if we're going to represent the one true living God is to allow our heart to be synced with his. Allow him to give us a new heart. Chapter 4, verse 1 says that Jonah was angry at this news. He was literally hot. He was steaming angry. He was going through the motions of obedience, but his heart wasn't in it at all. Grace had not fully sunk in. And Jonah probably knew from the other prophets of the Bible, people like Amos and Hosea, that the Israelites would eventually be conquered and decimated by the Assyrians. And that's probably why Jonah didn't like Nineveh, because the capital city of the Assyrian Empire would end up being Nineveh. And Jonah probably knew that. So he might have had a reason. But again, 600,000 people. Last time I preached on Jonah, I did the math. 600,000 people, so you can wrap your mind around that, is pretty much the cities of Ojai, Ventura, Oxnard, Port Hueneme, Santa Paula, Fillmore, Camarillo, and Moore Park. That's 600,000 people, roughly. And Jonah cared about them this much. And the question is, do we? Has God changed our heart to reach out beyond ourselves, beyond our comfort, beyond the blessing that he's given us, and shared that with other people? Jonah had what we call misplaced compassion. He cared more about this stupid plant that God raised up to give him shade than he did about all these lives. And the text says, not to mention the cattle, the animals, because that was their livelihood. They were an agricultural society. I'm going to wrap up this with one story. One of the most powerful stories of forgiveness I ever heard came from a lady named Corrie Ten Boom. Many of you older people know who she is. She was a survivor of the Holocaust, the persecution of the Jewish people back in the 40s. And the odd thing about Corrie Ten Boom is that she was Dutch. She wasn't Jewish. But her family got in trouble for smuggling Jewish people into their home and for giving them refuge and shelter. And a lot of stuff happened to Corrie Ten Boom, but probably one of the most horrific things that happened to her is she witnessed her own sister get killed right in front of her at the hands of an evil, mean security guard of the Nazi army. And years later, after the Holocaust, after the end of World War II, Corrie Ten Boom traveled throughout Europe preaching the gospel message. And it happened that on one particular occasion, after she closed with the gospel invitation, walking down the center row was the very same security guard at whose hands her sister was killed. And he was seeking God's forgiveness. And that was the moment that Corrie had to wrestle in her heart and in her soul. Do I believe in the truth of the gospel enough? Do I believe in the grace of God enough that I am willing to release my anger, to release all of my frustration over the death of my sister at the hands of this evil man, and extend to him the same grace and salvation and forgiveness that I myself have experienced? And of course she did. But I don't know if that was me, if I would have had the fortitude and the love and the compassion to do that. It's a pretty hard thing. There is no one so good that they're not in need of God's grace, and there's no one so bad that they can't find God's grace.